Buddhist Summer School, Thursday, 15th August, 1985. This is my lack of mindfulness. Venerable members of the Sangha and my fellow students and wayfarers in the Dhamma. It has been customary for several years to speak impromptu at our last meeting. But this morning, as I sat down in my room thinking about our meeting today, the talk began to flow. So I thought it might be useful if I wrote down what flowed in. Change is sometimes good, and I hope this time the change will be good. I will read first and then. First of all, my sincere thanks and gratitude to each and everyone for your loving support and appreciation. For I have learned so much from you, from your inspiring influence whilst preparing these talks at home, for I always visualize and feel to some extent your presence as I write them. Usually I start work on them in June, but this year, owing to circumstantial conditions, I started in February, so as to be on the safe side as regards their completion. The Buddhist Summer School is one of the happiest, perhaps the happiest week for me each year. It teaches me so much. Do remember, I learn from you. I am not trying to teach anyone. I always disclaim being a teacher. It's true that I taught chemistry at school for several years, and I have taught the piano to many pupils for over 30 years. But apart from that, where the holy life is concerned, I disclaim being a teacher. For me, everyone and everything in the world, every experience, pleasant or unpleasant, is my teacher. So I am just your servant. I hope a faithful servant. It is deep joy to be so. And my service meets its rewarding climax in this week of the Oak Room meetings with all of you each year. We all know the state of the world today. Nowhere is there peace and love, wisdom and beauty, except in such rare oases as groups like ours, scattered thinly in this vast desert of turbulence and sorrow. Of the inhumanity of man against his fellow humans, of the cruelly destructive predatoriness of man in relation to his mother, nature, who lavishly bestows her sustaining and nourishing gifts with such constant grace and benevolence upon her ungracious, noisy, and errant children. Each and every member of the human species is responsible for this. It is my greed which keeps the world starving for material, cultural, and spiritual food, thirsty for wisdom and true happiness, and the ambrosial waters of eternal life. It is my hate and violence which enables the four horsemen of the apocalypse to ride roughshod over all my brothers and sisters, to make every parent quake with fear for the very life of her beloved innocent children, to despoil this lovely Garden of Eden, this green earth shedding sad tears made bitter and poisonous by my evil. It is my stupidity, my illusions, my delusions, which are the dark and lowering thunderclouds blotting out the life-giving sunlight of wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, and bliss, all of which is my natural and rightful heritage. For I am the child of transcendence itself, totally embodied in me, as indeed in all of you and throughout the whole cosmos. My house, my home, is the infinite and eternal. My place of rest and peace is the immortal. The many mansions in our parents' house are no other than each and every one of us. We have to wake up to this truth and live nobly as befits the Aryans, and work ceaselessly for man's fruition through Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna. Who else but we and all such others, each in their own unique way, are the children of the new dawn? The children of the new dawn work quietly and skillfully, taking no pay, demanding no recompense in any shape or form. There can be no barter whatsoever with transcendence. So, gracefully accept what is freely gifted with love and joy. We are but servers of man's destiny. Hence, we must work without any display. We stand behind the curtains, hidden, unobtrusive. And we work in silence. No evangelism. Hold out your begging bowl filled with whatever you have to give. That is pure service as requested by transcendence. Requested, never ordered, for transcendence endures all our shortcomings. Let there be no conceit, no pride, no assertion of I, me, mine. Through our utter selflessness, transcendence realizes its own transcendent self. You have a wonderful gift, the priceless teachings of the Samma Sambuddha, the perfected Holy One. What will you do with your gift? Will you use it for yourselves, for your happiness, well-being? Or will you use it in service of all that there is? Not only human beings, but the animal world, the plant world, and this earth itself. This gift must not be squandered. And there are two ways of squandering it. One, directed to oneself, and one and the other imposed or attempted to be imposed upon others. Each person in the world is unique, utterly unique. We are all alike in one respect. The body is made of bones and blood and skin and muscle and so on. We know all that. But we don't know that this perishable existential being is the instrument, the apparatus through which transcendence manifests. And transcendence has given us this inestimable gift. It itself is totally embodied in us. When you realize the fruits of living the holy life, you will know the meaning, the full meaning of infinity, eternity, immortality. And you will recognize the real meaning of transcendence, which itself is nondescript. All the words of our languages confine us to the realm of the finite, the temporal, which is the realm of the mortal, death is Lord, is Prince of this world. It's deathlessness to which we rise, not because we have achieved anything, but we have done our duty in cleansing the temple of the Most High. And because of that cleansing, the transcendent functions freely through us. You may call the transcendent God, if you wish, or Brahman, or Atma, or you may call it pure mind or absolute consciousness. Call it what you will. But it is here and now embodied in us. What is the meaning of the statement that God or transcendence or Brahman is omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent? Its omnipotence lies in the fact that it allows us to go through that process of development which raises us out of our difficulties to the supreme heights of the Sammasambuddha. What is the meaning of omniscience? It is not that transcendence knows everything beforehand. It doesn't. If it did, we would be predestined, so to say. We would be imprisoned in a blueprint which was laid down for us as such. There is no such blueprint. Transcendence is no tyrant. Transcendence allows us to grow. The wise parent, the skillful parent, knows how to allow his child to grow. To grow happily. To grow peacefully. So too, transcendence allows everything. Now, this wonderful treasure that we have, this priceless, inestimable treasure of the teachings of the Sammasambuddha, is our responsibility. We have to handle it, utilize it in the right way, with infinite love, compassion, and Mahaprajna, wisdom. Therefore, let us not use it forcibly, because anything forcible has its roots in hate. Use it lovingly, kindly, patiently. And insofar as we ourselves become a light unto ourselves, wherever we are, that influence will go out to our entire environment and help everybody. When you plant a seed and the little plant begins to grow, you don't twist it and torture it to grow in the way you want it to grow. It will grow in its own sweet way. So, just as transcendence allows us to grow in our own unique way, we have to carry out that principle with respect to our whole environment. Now, we have to work in silence. Without silence, nothing which is truly good can come into being. What is the peak point of samadhi, of meditation? That meditative state is utterly silent, still. In the silence, the best things happen. The fetus in the womb grows at first in silence. The seed in the earth, which becomes the tree, also grows in silence. When we learn to be silent with our tongues, we will also learn to be silent with our brains. Because all through the day and the night in our sleep, that brain is constantly chattering, except when one is in deep, dreamless slumber. Now, physical slumber means, of course, that we have gone to sleep, that we are no longer conscious. But this spiritual state of utter silence is one in which enlightenment takes place. And that enlightenment is one which is associated with utter peace and joy, where there is no sensational turmoil. But if we learn to be silent in our ordinary physical life every day, we will learn to enter that transcendent silence, which is the realm of the Holy of Holies within us. So, I wish all of you peace, health, harmony, and holiness. And may all the felicities attendant upon living the holy life rest with you always. I think we have just a few moments. So, allow me to read the end of this book, The Heart of Religion. The heart of religion is the living of the religious life. It is the simple life, simple with the simplicity of creative genius. At first, the genius learns the rudiments of his art, the rules of his craft, and the errors he must avoid. in his maturity, a skilled master, his creative genius freely expresses itself. Remember the parable of the raft. You don't carry the raft of virtue with you when you have reached the other shore. Simplicity marks his creations, however complex their structure may be. So too is it with the religieux who realizes the supreme communion, which is the supreme samadhi. The simple religious life is the life beautiful, free of self-indulgence, fear, and violence. Feeling, thought, and speech, and all actions are pure, wise, and compassionate, free of greed, hate, and delusion. The simple religieux asks nothing. He is in harmony within himself and with the world, a true individual. And individuality means indivisibility. He is complete, whole, holy, perfect. He is selfless, he is awake. He is always mindful. His mindfulness never departs. The Buddha says that of himself too. And in the Upanishads, again and again, you will find that point brought out. Full of loving understanding, he is quiet. He refrains from everything unnecessary. This is the true meaning of asceticism. An ascesis is a sloughing off of all that is unnecessary. So he does not disturb the peace or spoil the beauty of nature or of transcendence. The simple living of the religious life is to live in full communion in and with the world. Silent and still, it is the music of transcendence and the pulse of life for him who has ears to hear and eyes to see. Always in communion, the religious man is the happy man, the intelligent man, the free man. He is the invisible focus through whom radiates all that transcendence pours into him. He is virtue. Exemplar of religious living, he is the being through whom transcendence has come to full self-realization as man, proving immortality through the mortal. In this conjunction of transcendence and man, the one total reality comes to blissful knowledge of its own infinitude, wholly embodied in all finites. That is the extraordinary thing about the infinite and the eternal. It is totally embodied in every aspect of manifestation, from an atom or a virus to a galaxy or the perfected Holy One. The brain cannot picture it, but you will sense it if you are quiet, if you can enter the silence. The moment of the galaxy is different from the moment of the earth, which again is different from the moment of a man or a flower. Here now, the absolute is resolved into the relative, and the Holy One is absolved out of disjunction, the sinful state, dukkha, into timeless conjugation within transcendence, as life and death work in accord through his whole being. The Holy One has no mind of his own. You know how we say about a person, oh, he's got a mind of his own. The Holy One has no such mind, because that mind of his own is a separative evil agent in our life. It's the imposition of selfness upon the world. That mind of his own, that smokescreen of mental obstructs all separation, such as the conscious and the unconscious mind, is no more, for his receptive, responsive sensitivity is transparently open to transcendence, and the void is illumined by the light of awareness. Released from all bonds, cooled and pure, there is no resistance by the unified, unconditioned mind to the transcendent mind's measureless power as it works through him, the unshattered, transmuting all that is drawn into that field of beneficence. When the energy of the transcendent mind flows through you, the organism has to be well prepared, otherwise it would be shattered. This is well known in India, for instance. I don't know about other countries. So, the purified one remains unshattered. The apparatus can take the voltage of the transcendent. He himself is then the living Word, Lord of heaven in earth, fountainhead of the liberating truth of religion that spells man's salvation, a focal point of creative action in eternity. Such is the supreme communion. In this constant beatitude, in which I am the I which has given up I. These are the words of Shiva to his disciple, which comes in one of the Upanishads, one of the lovely Upanishads. Where mind is unshakably poised and free, ever still and silent, the senses are not only the cords of communion, but also the channels of transmutative power. This is why and how the Holy One can perform miracles, as we call them. So, when the living revelation looks at you at any moment, he sees you as you actually are, and in that same instant, through his eye, the third eye, transcendence sees itself in you as man, the perfected man. In this divine moment of truth, grace touches you if your heart is quietly aflame with love and wholly open to the compassionate Holy One. That touch heals you, and in that healing is the creative renewal of all the world. Such is the fulfilling of religious living, the heart of religion.